the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York. This is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence. What happens when you mix the two, and where? Like any responsible little brother, we turn down the volume when we talk, and we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Also in the studio with us today, we have Phil Palmateer and Lillian Lasher. Say hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay.
I'm little brother's little sister.
You know, I'm just sitting here with this big metal microphone in front of my face, and it's rather intimidating. I feel like I'm being probed by aliens.
You'll get used to it soon enough. So anyway, up tonight, we're going to go through the headlines as usual. We're also going to talk about the arrest of Dmitry Skylyarov, CDs with copy protection, and give you an update on Napster. That is as soon as things stop being chaotic around here. So stay tuned, because Little Brother is right around the corner. Okay, and we're back, and things have quieted down a little bit, so let's see what we can do here with a little bit of headlines. Before we get started here, I need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed on this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union. If you'd like to express your opinion here, the phone number at WRPI Studio is area code 518-276-6248. And if you don't feel like expressing your opinion via the phone, you can also email me. My email address is critter@verizoneatspoop, that's all one word, .com. That address is, again, is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. Also would like to welcome two more stations to the Little Brother lineup, and I've been meaning to welcome these guys for a couple episodes in a row now, and I apologize for having missed it. However, new to the lineup is Variety Radio 98.1 in Warrenton, Virginia, and Radio Lava Lamp in Osaka, Japan. Welcome aboard, guys. Well, we have an article here that came in from Daniel P. Dern. It says, usually I do my work-related travel between Boston and New York by plane, but I've been meaning to try the train again, especially Amtrak's allegedly faster Acela. So I call the company travel office to make reservations, already know which trains, whatever the rail equivalent of a flight is, that I want. An email confirmation shows up a few minutes later with a URL pointing to an itinerary. The itinerary showed the correct train numbers and the arrival time, but no departure times. And had me going between something like Aptco Test, Texas, and someplace in Arkansas. I called the travel group back, they called Amtrak, and my reservation is correct, but when Amtrak's system passed the information to the next system, it tried to parse the city codes as airport codes. More obvious than the metric versus English glitch, but it still shows that just because two programs can talk to each other doesn't mean that they've agreed on just exactly what they're saying. Fortunately, if I get on a southbound train from Boston traveling at 10 miles an hour accompanied by a parrot with a balloon tied to 1 foot, it'll still be hard to miss arriving in New York. Eli Lilly sent an announcement that it was discontinuing a mailing list using CC instead of BCC. Some of the more than 600 recipients were unhappy about having their email addresses and Prozac use disclosed because the purpose of the list was to send out reminders to fill prescriptions for the antidepressant drug. According to a Computer World article, Eli Lilly is preparing a code audit review working on a program that would block all outbound emails with more than one address. The American Civil Liberties Union has asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate. This kind of error is made frequently by new users of email software, but it's interesting, but perhaps not surprising, to see that corporations running large mailing lists occasionally make the same error. In either case, it's merely an annoyance or a strategic embarrassment in most cases, such as effectively giving away your customer list to your competitors. However, in this case, the desire of the patients to keep their medical condition private does add a rather serious layer to the risk. On July 11th, 2001, the power levels in Livermore, California dropped to voltages so low that air conditioners and computers could no longer operate. Computers and air conditioning units went off, and moment by moment, some lighting systems ended up burnt out. And those without UPSs on their computers had significant data corruption. It's especially noteworthy that this area was not on the list for scheduled for blackouts. It turned out to be a set of changes that they were making in the infrastructure. Half of one house became out of power while the other half still worked. They had to use motor generators for the down half until it was determined what was up, then switched over to a crossfeed for the rest of the house. When power came back on, they switched back. Thank you, UPSs and motor generators. There's an interesting thread over at DSL Reports discussing Phoenix Technology's new BIOS. The BIOS contains the PhoenixNet Internet Launch System. ILS resides safely within the ROM and is activated the first time a user launches PhoenixNet-enabled PC with a Windows 98 operating system. When the PhoenixNet ILS detects an internet connection, it makes contact with the PhoenixNet server and delivers user-selectable services. These services are delivered to the user as hot links on the desktop and in the web browser as applications that PhoenixNet automatically packages, downloads, and installs. It's 3 a.m. Do you know who your motherboard's talking to? Recently discovered an incoming number on the caller ID that looks suspiciously as a hack. The number comes in as 212-555-1212, which is a long-distance directory service for New York, New York, and as far as I know, cannot be an originating number. Upon calling Verizon Communications, which serves both the home 201 area code and New York's 212, and their service representative confirmed that the call could not have originated from this number, but refused to speculate on why it would be seen on the caller ID. I wonder how long it will take for exploits of such holes in telecommunications infrastructure to invalidate law enforcement evidence. Anyway, it looks like we have a caller on the line, so let's go to him. Hello, caller. You're on Little Brother.
Yes, may I speak with David D., please?
David D. has left the station. I'm sorry.
Okay, I got a question for you. I got an appointment to call, because... Hold on, let me put the guy in the phone. Hold on.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, I was supposed to get interviewed over the air. At 8 o'clock, they told me to call.
Okay.
Albany. Where you go along?
I don't know anything about that. Are you sure it was supposed to be this evening and not tomorrow evening?
No, today. Yeah, it was today for the 20th.
Okay.
Is really going on right there?
I didn't schedule an interview with anybody, so I don't know. I don't know anything about it.
It was for the Albany Puerto Rican Parade, something like that.
Okay, I believe that might be Saturday evening that you're looking at.
Saturday evening.
Yeah, give that another shot tomorrow night. All right.
All right, man.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, let's bring the music back up then. Okay, here's an interesting one for you. This came to us from John Arundel. He notes that Inova notes that an IBM system to stop drivers from falling asleep at the wheel works by asking you questions, and if you fail to respond promptly, it shoots a jet of cold water at you. In the time-honored phrase, the risks are obvious. I wouldn't like to imagine the consequences if a driver was unexpectedly soaked with ice-cold water during a high-speed passing maneuver. Henry Baker writes to us that he just got a new set of linear polarized sunglasses and got an unpleasant surprise. He can't read the LCD displays in his car or his wife's car without cocking his head to one side. On his car, he says, I have to cock my head to one side by about 15 degrees. With my wife's car, I have to cock my head to the other side by 40 degrees. Luckily, the same angle of cocking seems to work for all of the LCD gauges at the same time. considering the fact that polarized sunglasses are often better than unpolarized sunglasses for daylight driving because they do a better job of filtering out glare, which is highly likely to be polarized, we actually have one safety item interfering with another. So why can't car manufacturers install LCDs in such a manner that the polarization is compatible with polarized sunglasses? Or better yet, go back to an analog gauge. Works quite well. Let's see, what else do we have here?
That's not as interesting and shiny.
I know it's not as interesting.
They like shiny objects. Just like a bunch of squirrels.
But I'm going to tell you something.
Shiny things.
I'm going to tell you something. Analog technology works extremely well, and I know it's not always the most exciting thing to look at, but you're sitting on the other side of the board. If you were sitting on this side of the board, you would see everything here except for the clock as analog technology.
So it's not shiny? Why would I want to see that?
It is shiny.
It is
It's shiny. Just analog.
It's analog shiny.
Analog is not a bad thing. Oh, let's see here. AVWeb, which is a news service for general aviation, reported on July 9th that the FAA has issued an emergency airworthiness directive on one model of the Apollo NavCom, which is a combined navigation and communications radio, with a specific DSP software version number because its bearing indication was found to be off by as much as 14 degrees. The emergency AD prohibits any flight in an aircraft equipped with the radio until it's marked use for navigation prohibited. That doesn't make a lot of sense. You'd think that if it was use for navigation... I guess you're supposed to then revert to the old way, sight navigation. The navigation function relies on special ground stations that, simplifying a bunch, transmit a signal that varies the phase of the modulation with the azimuth, allowing the radio to figure out its bearing from a station within a degree or two. An aircraft flying a circle around a station sees the modulation change smoothly. For many aircraft, this is the primary navigation system when flying by instruments in clouds. 50 miles out and 14 degrees off could put you in conflict with FAA airspace rule, which is bad because it requires some explanation, or worse yet, mountains, which is even worse because it requires a funeral. In comparison, suddenly not being able to fly by instruments doesn't look so bad. The AD text suggests that some stations do not adhere to the nominal 30 Hz modulation frequency, but the DSP software depends on the assumption that they do. I would guess that the bench testing was done with only nominally generated signals and certification flight testing, if needed, only with stations that happened to be nominal. So no problems showed up until a technician happened to test a new installation in the presence of a non-standard signal. The risks are assuming, testing within assumptions, and having software in the gauges. We got an item here from Jay Haynes, who says, I just made an airline reservation using the webpage. When I got all the way to the end, having put in my credit card information, it said fatal error in back end, and gave me an error number and dumped me out. So I assumed, foolish assumption, that the thing had failed and started all over. The second time, everything worked as it should. Then I read my email and found I had email confirmations for both of the reservations. So I called the airline and got connected to a tech support person, and he said, yep, I've got two reservations on the same flight, and that he would cancel one of them and would simply issue a refund to my credit card for it. He said the software is supposed to catch cases of the same person making two reservations on the same flight, but in this case, that didn't work either. For me, this is a case of deja vu all over again. Some 10 or more years ago, I reported using an online banking money transfer system where I put in all the data and then the computer voice said, system error, session terminated. So I put the transaction in a few more times over the space of a few days until I got the normal data accepted thank you message. And soon after, I got a call from the bank about the account being way overdrawn because, in fact, every one of the transactions went through. No doubt there are other systems out there which have the possibility of completing a transaction and then telling the user that there's been a fatal error. Maybe a whole lot of them. A series of government initiatives have accidentally made public after the wrong version of a speech by Cabinet Minister Stephen Byers, this is in the UK, was released. Civil servants unintentionally circulated an electronic copy to interested bodies, which can be opened to reveal which passages have been removed or added during drafting. This, of course, is not a new item. This is something that's been discussed on this show several times in the past. and basically amounts to an issue with Microsoft Word, wherein it maintains all of your past copies, and that information can be retrieved fairly easily. If you submit your information to an SSL-protected web page that you believe you're protected, right? Well, not always. Check the EAA, that's the Experimental Aircraft Association webpage that lets you join online. It looks good, the browser indicates that it's 128-bit encryption, it inspires confidence until you look at the page source. What they found in the page source is a line that says form method equals post, action equals send mail. It certainly appears that the 128-bit encrypted SSL form proceeds to send out your sensitive information via email in clear text. I verified this by modifying the form to send the mail to me. I then tried it, and sure enough, the entire form is sent in the clear, including credit card number. So much for that one. Back in a minute.
Get my
You're listening to WRPI. The show is Little Brother, and it looks like we have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Hello. You know, I really hate it when they do that.
Hello, caller. You're off the air.
It's about the size of it.
I think we should just start calling people ourselves randomly. Start asking them technical questions.
I think maybe he was intimidated by the microphones, too.
Well, it's a possibility. I don't know. I think this is something that happens to everybody. We were discussing, of course, the basic, while the music was playing, the discussion in the studio was on the basic topic of stage fright, and it is something very real. And
the
when
callers
you,
get it too.
When you when you actually find yourself being pointed at by a microphone that's connected to a 10,000-watt transmitter that's blasting a signal out over every radio in a 40-mile radius that happens to be tuned to this particular frequency.
Which
and
is what,
being
five radios?
Okay, Chuck, you're making it worse.
Yeah, but you know, I gotta yank your chain. Okay, so let's see what we have going on here now. We got a couple of articles on the topic of Napster. By the way, if you do want to chime in, the phone number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. And I would like to hear from you. You can talk about any of the topics that I've covered so far, and I realize that I've covered a lot in a very short time span. You can cover any other topic that I bring up, or if you have a technical question or a technical topic that you'd like to bring up, by all means, bring it up. The number again, 518-276-6248. So last week I told you about a decision by Judge Patel out in California that said that Napster was required to remain offline until they could guarantee a 100% success at filtering out songs that the record industry required them to filter out. And at the point in time, they were looking at a 99.4% success rate or something to that effect. And in actual practical tests, they found the success rate to be even better than that. However, the judge said 100%, nothing less. Well, the decision by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals over... There was a decision by the 9th U.S. Court of Appeals that overturns that judge's ruling, but it remained unclear whether Napster would ever resume its free song swapping service as it gets ready to deploy a paid subscription service later this year. Ricky Seidman of Napster says, "We have no immediate comment on when we're going to start." U.S. District Judge Marilyn Hall Patel issued the shutdown order on July 11th after a court hearing in which Napster said it was about to restart its music sharing service following a short hiatus to retool the song screening software. Napster was sued by the recording industry in 1999 for copyright infringement, but said it could now block more than 99% of all infringing song files, but Patel told Napster that it needed to block 100% of unauthorized copyrighted songs or stay off indefinitely. Napster immediately sought relief from the appeals court, which overturned Patel in a two-sentence order. Napster's free song sharing service has been down since July 2nd. The Recording Industry Association of America noted that the court only temporarily lifted Patel's order and will hear arguments on the case later this year. At that time, the industry said it expects to prevail. "We are confident that after a thorough review," said Kerry Sherman of the RIAA, "that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will uphold Judge Patel's decision." Sherman added that the three-judge panel's decision still requires Napster to remove copyrighted works that both Patel and the appeals court have found were violating copyright laws. "It's important to note that today's ruling does not change in any way the fact that Napster must prevent copyrighted works from appearing on its system as previously ordered by the court."
Boy, it's a shame that it's just a temporary lift, though, on that judgment. I mean, could anybody guarantee 100% success at anything?
I mean, could
that judge, for example, say that it was a she, right, Marilyn?
Yes.
Could she say with any certainty that her decisions as a judge are 100% correct?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. I mean, she's certainly wrong about this.
And what you're on there is exactly what Napster's counter-argument was, is that the process involves human beings, and human beings are not flawless. In fact,
even the software is made by human beings who are not flawless, and thus software itself is inherently not flawless.
Yes, we're talking about software made by human beings and therefore not flawless. That runs on machines made by human beings and therefore not flawless. And the machines are expected to carry out this work. But the problem is that the work that we're looking at here, that that Judge Patel expected the machines to do, requires common sense and judgment, which is something which are two things that computers are completely lacking in.
You know, and also speaking of common sense and judgment, common sense people out there now that can't download much off of Napster anymore are making their way to Gnutella.com, I believe. Gnutella.com.
It's Gnutella.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure it's it may be .com. I know there's also another one at .org and another one at .net.
Well, you can always run a search.
Well, there's LimeWire, any of the Gnutella clients that are peer-to-peer, they can't shut them down.
Right,
I
exactly.
I don't understand why people even try using Napster anymore.
Well, there's not much point at this point.
It's not really worth the effort, I found. Napster worked on a semi-centralized principle. They took all the stuff that was the bandwidth hog, that is the actual carrying of the files from one computer to another, off of the servers, but there was still a server sitting in the middle whose purpose was to tell any other computer where to find a particular song, what other computer to hook up to. When you go in and you hook up from one computer to another, let's say you go out looking for a particular song, the server would say, okay, this computer over here has it, go get it. Your computer would then contact that computer directly. The server was now out of the loop. In fact, you could even log off of Napster and whatever download you started would continue. Under Gnutella, the concept is slightly different. The search is carried out by basically a sort of a rumor chain. Your Gnutella is aware of a number of other Gnutellas, and it just starts asking around. And eventually, hopefully, land something. Actually, usually it'll land a lot of things, but it'll burn a lot of bandwidth doing it, and that's the major downside to it.
So there's no central server to sue in that case.
Oh, exactly. That's it, exactly. And in fact,
I'm sure they'll find a way around that eventually.
Gnutella was originally created by Nullsoft, the same people that that created the freeware Winamp, the freeware Winamp MP3 player. And when AOL bought Nullsoft, they ordered that the Gnutella project got stomped. So what we have now is not the Gnutella as it was originally intended, but rather Gnutella with a G on the beginning of it, which you had mentioned when you spelled Gnutella. And that indicates a free software product. And there are a lot of clients for this one, and they're all intercompatible, and you don't even have to touch a website to do this, which is really pretty cool, I think. At any rate, if you want to express your opinion, we'd love to hear from you, too. Area code 518-276-6248.
Yes, we'd love to get some real callers.
Yes, we would.
For us. They have something to say about technology.
Actually, we have a little bit of computer history with us here tonight. Phil, you had a CD you wanted to run here.
Yeah, I stumbled across a website that I don't recall what it was now, but it had a lot of vintage Commodore 64 music. Of course, it's not the best sounding stuff in the world, but it's a little bit of nostalgia, and it'll give you a little flashback into what the original computers actually sounded like. So it should be interesting if anyone remembers the good old days, the Commodore. And
of course, we're putting a date on ourselves by doing this.
Now, how can you say it's not the best stuff in the world? I mean, come on, it's cheeserific.
Well, let's
it's craptacular.
All right, let's just run the CD here. Okay. We'll cut it off there. You're listening to WRPI Troy. The show is Little Brother, and we have a caller, so let's see what he has to say. Caller, you are on the air.
Oh, I know I was calling a airline. I'm calling from Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
And I'm looking. I'm on the internet here.
Okay.
And I've been looking for Jim Pepper's Powwow, and I see you're looking for it too. So I was calling to see if you had found it.
You see that we're looking for it?
Yeah.
Are you listening to us right now?
No, I'm in Minnesota, man.
Well, yeah, I know, but we have a real audio feed. I didn't know if you were tuned into.
No.
And by the way, for our listeners, if you're in an area where the reception is poor, you can get us by real audio at www.wrpi.org. I just thought I would throw that out while we were on the topic. I'm sorry, caller, go ahead. Are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
I don't think you want me on the air.
Well, all right. Let me drop you off the air, and we'll get somebody in the office to pick you up, all right?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And we'll drop that nice flanging effect off of here, if I can just find the right fader. There we go. Okay. And bring the music back up. There we go. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, so we've got another one here. By the way, once again, the caller, if you have a... Let me start that sentence all over again, because that was way wrong. If you would like to call us, the phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. And if you have an opinion to express and you don't feel like putting your own voice on the air, you can send an email to me at critter@verizoneatspoop.com. And I will be more than happy to lend my voice to your comments.
You know, and even if you don't have an opinion to express, really, 518-276-6248, just anybody that wants to talk to us would be great. Anybody at all.
All right. So, at any rate, according to Macrovision, the company that has provided the technology to several major music labels to copy protect compact discs from being copied from a CD onto a PC, they have been testing for about 4 to 6 months, and although not disclosing which titles have been loaded with the technology, at least one new title that is now on the shelves in record stores has sold close to 100,000 copies. The technology, which inserts an audible clicks and pops into music files that are copied from a CD to a PC, highlights what could become a critical part of the major music labels' efforts to stem digital piracy. Although the labels can do little to stop consumers from ripping or digitally copying the hundreds of millions of CDs already on the market, they're looking for ways to protect new releases, which constitute the bulk of their annual sales. But the tests also take aim at the basic consumer practice of copying CDs to a computer for personal use without ever trading the songs with others. Although this is a familiar and legally protected task in the world of cassette tapes, the legality of creating music collections of a personal computer is more cloudy.
Do you think would the copy protection still work if you had, say, a home CD player and you pumped the audio output into the input of the sound card and then just digitized it coming into the computer that way?
No, absolutely not. That won't be that won't be halted at all. Although there's, I guess the general point of view is that somebody is not going to want a recording that had an analog step in the middle. You know, it goes back to what Lillian here was saying about digital being nice and shiny.
Yes. American consumers love shiny objects.
Yeah, but most MP3s aren't quite CD quality anyway, so I don't think it would make much of a difference to the average user.
I don't know. Does the average user really know that?
Well, I don't know that the average user does know that. The average consumer.
So user-friendly.
Exactly.
Anyone could sit down on a computer and rip a CD these days.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to nip in the bud this process of doing a digital rip. I suppose that the major advantage to doing a digital rip is that you can also do it very fast. Although, here's an interesting aside. I was reading some comments that were made on the internet about this thing, and apparently there are some ripper programs that are not affected by this. Most of them that operate in the free software realm are actually not affected by this. For example, CD Paranoia, which is available for the Linux operating system, if that's your operating system of choice. What instead is affected is mostly the commercial ones that operate on Windows. And the reason that they're so badly affected by it is because of the fact that they're using a fairly sloppy fetch routine to fetch the data off of the CD. Effectively, what the ones that do bypass this copy protection scheme do that is they implement the same algorithms that are implemented normally in a CD player. If you're going to do the function of a CD player, why not implement a CD player rather than try to take shortcuts all over the place and hope the CD is good?
And some people think you can't get anything good for free. And computers, apparently you can get the best for free.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily the best, but I'm quite happy with them myself. At any rate, where was I on this one? Record companies have toyed with protecting CDs against copying for several years, but the technology is a difficult one because anything added to a CD risks degrading the sound on an ordinary CD player to the point where audiophiles or even ordinary customers start complaining. And in fact, this has been the case in video for a long time now. There's a video copy protection system out there by these same people, Macrovision, which does, in some cases, especially on high-end equipment, degrade video performance of a VHS recorder or of a digital satellite system. And a lot of videophiles have been very upset about it for the 15 years that it's been in use, but it's so deeply entrenched that people have kind of gotten used to it. The most high-profile effort, the Cross-Industry Secure Digital Music Initiative, has all but scrapped its plans to add digital watermarks to recorded music after disagreements between labels, consumer device manufacturers, and technology companies derailed the effort. The Macrovision tests are based on a technology acquired from an Israeli company, TTR Technologies. Rather than blocking copying altogether, the technology introduces some digital distortion into a file. Macrovision says this is all but inaudible when a CD is played through an ordinary CD player, but when a song is copied to a digital format on a PC hard drive, the distortion shows up as annoying clicks and pops in the music. The company said that it and the labels are in large part testing to see if the changes in the audio are audible to consumers. Reports so far have turned up no significantly higher number of CD returns or consumer complaints, said a spokeswoman.
You know, how do they know that those clicks and pops won't make the music better?
Well, you never know. I mean, if you were listening to industrial music, for example, it might actually fall right into place. Exactly.
Yeah. Or in the case of some of your other types of music, I'll not point fingers or name names, but in the case of some of the music coming from the major labels that would be using this, it would be a distinct improvement, I'm sure. Anything to mask the horrendous sound that's actually coming off the CD.
Oh, you know, you don't need to shy away from naming names or around here. I mean, this is an alternative radio station, and we play music, and a lot of it is not mainstream. So feel free to pick on the mainstream if you feel so inclined.
And we clear whatever we say by saying that it's not necessarily the opinion of RPI.
At any rate, what was I going to say next? I forget.
That'll teach you to bring extra people into the studio.
Yeah, right. Well, let's bring the music up for a moment. anyway, if you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth, or more, after all, we could always use donations, please feel free to give us a call at area code 518-276-6248. Okay, this is one that I knew had to be coming down the line. As soon as they were talking about a move to digital TV and making the move mandatory, I knew that something like this was going to come down. This article comes to us from Reuters. In a landmark deal that could provide crucial momentum to the nation's foundering digital TV transition, Sony and Warner Brothers are expected Tuesday to announce a pact with the world's top electronics makers to open their vast libraries in exchange for some copy control. The agreement covers only content carried over cable systems, a sticking point that has left the studios divided. The other five majors, some of whom have extensive broadcast interests, want over-the-air broadcasting to be protected as well. Sony and Warner Brothers went ahead and signed their own deal late Friday with a licensing authority for Hitachi, Intel Corporation, Matsushita Electrical Industrial, Sony Corporation, and Toshiba Corporation. The deal permits the two studios to dictate how many times, if any, high-value programming can be recorded. The seven majors have been in intense negotiations for months with five electronics makers, who argue that there is no point in mass-producing digital TV sets if Hollywood isn't willing to offer top programming. The agreements with Warner Brothers and Sony Pictures marked a watershed event in the transition to the all-digital home entertainment, said Michael Ayers, president of the Digital Transmission Licensing Administration. Studio execs said the other five majors are exploring different licensing schemes with unidentified electronics manufacturers, but offered no specific details. It's also possible that those studios could eventually join Warner Brothers and Sony, even if one at a time. The difference among the studios reflects differing opinions on how copy protection should be approached, said one industry exec. Hollywood's top lobbyist, the Motion Picture Association of America president Jack Valenti, has said that digital TV produces such a perfect picture that even amateurs could successfully pirate the content. The Warner and Sony agreement greenlights encryption technology that would essentially allow digital TV sets and cable boxes to communicate with each other. If a cable operator restricted a certain Warner Brothers movie from being copied ad infinitum, the cable box and digital TV set would relay that information to each other. The licensing agreement also includes technology preventing a cable line from being hooked up to the internet. The National Cable and Telecommunications Association endorsed encryption technology for set-top boxes earlier this year. For content providers, the creation of secure entertainment networks is key to the delivery of high-value, high-resolution motion picture content into the home, said Christopher Cookson, Warner Brothers Executive VP for Technology. Fox Film Entertainment and the Walt Disney Company have been leading proponents of copy-protecting over-the-air broadcasting. Big surprise. A controversial notion, since over-the-air is, by its literal definition, free and clear. Broadcasters say that they will be crippled if over-the-air programming isn't protected. A content provider will turn exclusively to cablers, leaving broadcasters out of the mix. In the early 1980s, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that consumers have a right to record TV programs for home viewing. Consumer advocates say that the decision means over-the-air broadcasts can't be copy-protected, period. Disney and Fox say otherwise, arguing that advancing technology has changed the boundaries. The National Association of Broadcasters President, CEO, Eddie Fritz, has been appealing directly to Capitol Hill politicians on the issue. Irrespective of copy protection, the transition to digital TV has other crucial hurdles to overcome. Broadcasters are slated to go all digital by 86, or once 85% of American homes have a digital TV, whichever comes first. I'll tell you, the price tags I've seen on digital TVs, I'm pretty certain that we're going to hit 2006 before we hit 85% saturation.
You know, and there's something very basic I don't understand about digital television.
Shoot.
And, you know, I know it's not the heart of the matter in that article. Of course, neither is the price of it, I guess, so I'll go right ahead with this. Do you really need a perfect picture when you're watching reruns of The Simpsons? Do you need it? You know, when you're watching Everybody Loves Raymond, you know, do you absolutely have to have Deborah's face, you know, crystal clear?
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt, but, you know, you gotta have The Simpsons in perfect theatrical quality on a widescreen TV. blown up big, just like it looks in it, just like you were watching it in a movie theater.
I mean, is there really anything on cable or broadcast that you really need a perfect picture for? Is there anything that's that mind-bogglingly incredible to look at?
I'll tell you, quite honestly, personally, I'd just fine without a picture at all.
That's, you know, digital mania. Digital mania. America, it's full of digital mania.
It is digital mania. I can see some benefits to going to a digital TV system. One of them is that it does make more efficient use of the available chunk of radio spectrum that's set aside for television. But the problem with that is that while the system itself does make more efficient use of it, the rules as they were laid out to allocate a certain chunk of spectrum to a particular TV station would not they haven't changed. There's a 6 megahertz chunk of radio spectrum occupied by every television station, and to put that into some perspective for you, you could fit somewhere around 30 FM radio stations inside that same space, that same amount of spectrum. And with digital TV, it's possible to crunch down the amount of space you actually need to only 1 megahertz, but TV stations are still being given 6 megahertz to work with.
Personally, I'd love to get a digital television, but it has to have analog channel display on it.
Okay, so Phil here wants a digital TV with a rotary knob to change the channel.
Exactly, just like the good old days.
They'll never make it. You're the only kind of quirky American consumer that would want anything, you know, old-fangled.
Somebody'll make something like that, but it'll cost you an extra $3,000.
Phil will make it himself.
I want one of those old hardwood cabinets that open up with the doors and the hinges.
Oh.
I think everybody wants one of those.
Oh, those are actually pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Those are very nice to look at.
Mm. Yeah, you know, actually, you can get those at Eddie Bauer. Stickley, too.
Yeah, kind that you need, like, Murphy's oil soap to polish.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for that matter, you know, just about any furniture store you can... Any furniture store you can think of should carry one.
As a matter of fact, you cannot... It is almost impossible to find one of those armoire things that is not actually an entertainment system. It is darn near impossible.
Okay.
So what you're saying is the bandwidth is allocated, whether
yes.
they use it or not.
Yes. In fact...
Do you think that they'll change the allocation? If they do, will there be more room on the radio waves for quality programs such as ours?
No. Okay. It'll never happen.
It'll never happen.
At least I'm not very optimistic about it. That's obvious. Actually, a lot of the allocations have already been made. I know that Channel 23 in this area is going to be moving to Channel 4 when they go digital. For a short period of time, they'll be operating on both Channels 4 and 23 until they think they've got enough people that they can shut off 23.
Mm.
You know? And that's actually something that got a lot of people's knickers in a knot because of the fact that they felt that the TV stations and the broadcasting industry was being handed a very big gift from the U.S. government in the form of all this excess bandwidth. On the radio side of things, when radio is in the process of going digital, if it ever actually takes off, which, believe it or not, there is a process in place to try to do this. What will happen on the radio side is they're going to be requiring the radio stations that choose to go digital to operate digital and analog simultaneously on the same channel.
So even if they change the allocation of the bandwidth, it doesn't change the technology that people are receiving it with, correct?
I'd try that one again.
Well, for example, you can use less bandwidth, right? But that will turn 23 into 4 because it's lower on the...
No, it's just that the channels, all of the channels, regardless of what channel they happen to be, are 6 megahertz wide.
Okay.
It's just that channel 23 happens to be the 23rd one in.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been handed channel 4 so that when they are preparing to go digital, they can take and use channel 4 to transmit a digital signal, while they're still using channel 23 to transmit an analog signal. And what will happen is after channel 23 and 4 have been on the air simultaneously for a period of time, they'll shut off channel 23, and channel 23 is again available to be allocated to somebody else with enough money.
Gotcha. And then there'll be Fox 4.
Exactly.
Yeah, I gotcha.
That's exactly it.
Actually, that rolls off the tongue easier.
It does, doesn't it?
Fox 4.
It's funny. I was recently
Programming, great new name. Fox 4. Completely content-free news. Fox 4.
Well, the content-free news is likely to continue on. There's no doubt about that. Okay, got an item from the Register. This one says that the Linux-based drawing program K-Illustrator is now known as Contour. Apparently, the program's author, Dr. Kai-Uwe Sattler, and the University of Magdeburg, which employs him, were on the end of a stiff letter from a legal firm demanding that they stop using the K-Illustrator name, as it damaged the reputation of Adobe's similarly named product, Illustrator. Worse still, the lawyers demanded that the university pay $2,000 to cover their costs. As the name suggests, K-Illustrator is similar to Adobe's famous program, but has been developed as part of the K-Office suite, an office-like suite of programs for KDE user interface running over Linux. Sattler told the lawyers that he would change the product's name to avoid any confusion with Adobe's Illustrator, but did not want to pay somebody else's legal bills. The legal letter came from Reinhard Skurka and Weiss and Partner, a German patent law firm. Adobe seemed to be as unhappy with Dr. Sattler about the tone of the letter, and it's possible that this is because Adobe had not hired the law firm to do this job. It seems that in Germany, law firms can write cease and desist letters to businesses that they think are infringing another company's trademarks without being employed by the latter and demand payment from the company on the receiving end of the letter. Apparently, some law firms make a good living at this. Jeepers. Glad we don't have that
system
here.
Boy, and after they went to all that trouble to change the name to K-Drawing Thingy.
Yeah, right? I think they changed it to Contour or something like that.
Contour, that's what you said.
Yeah.
I like K-Drawing Thingy better.
K-Drawing Thingy. Yeah, that does have a kind of a nice...
Kind of a ring. Fox 4. K-Drawing Thingy.
At any rate... I had another item that I had wanted to put some information out on, but I don't, in a completely boneheaded move, yours truly has managed to lose track of all the information I had. But I'm going to try to talk about this one from memory. Recently, there was a hacker convention, which was called DEF CON, and at this particular convention, the mention of Adobe was what brought this up to my, up to mind. At this particular hacker convention, there was a speech given on the topic of how the encryption works inside of Adobe PDF files when you receive an encrypted PDF file. The speaker's name was Dmitry Skilarov, and I probably just massacred his name terribly. And he's a programmer for a company called Elcomsoft, which is out of Russia. And they did actually produce a program which would break the PDF encryption in many cases. And at this point in time, Skliarov, I think that's the correct pronunciation of his name, has been arrested. And actually, the EFF is calling for protests of Adobe on the 23rd of this month. So if you happen to be in Adobe's neighborhood, which... nobody in the Capital District is, but if you happen to be traveling to California, by all means, participate. Okay, and we are up against the clock here. So we're going to wrap it up for this weekend, or for this particular week. My name is Chuck Ritter. For Phil and Lil, we're signing off. And that's a wrap. You've been listening to Little Brother. Email can be sent to me at critter@verizoneatspoop.com. This program can also be picked up off of the ANFOS Radio Project at www.radioforall.net. And we're going to lead out here with a cut from the Matrix soundtrack.
3, 2, 1, 2!
Okay, let's try that one again. That was not off of the Matrix soundtrack. We were originally going to lead off with something from there. What we're actually going to lead off with is Negative Land with Car Bomb.
A technology show having technical problems.
Go figure.
No, I'll hear possibility.